You're listening to WPWK, loud and proud.
This is Colleen with you. I'm from Classic Album Sundays, and I'm hosting a few shows today. And I have a great guest in the studio with me, the legendary sound man, Bob Heil from Heil Sound. How are you?
I'm honored to be here, especially with the Paul Klipsch family.
Well, we're really happy to have you as well. I know he held a very special place in your heart, which we'll get to later. But I wanted to talk about some very significant developments in sound that you contributed to before you even met Paul Klipsch. Well, let's start at the very beginning. You got into music by playing the church organ.
No, wasn't the church organ. It was the theater organ in the cinema. I never did play church organ. My parents, wonderful, just unbelievable parents, back in the 50s, bought me a Hammond B organ. You were talking the B3 type.
With the Leslie.
Then it was a B2. This was amazing for a 12-year-old kid. But they thought that I should have that. So I did, and I took to it like duck to water, played my heart out 3-4 hours a day. And actually, by listening to a lot of George Wright records, I would transpose those onto an old Webcor tape recorder. And that tape recorder was very special. You could slow the speed down. And so when he'd do runs, I could slow it down and figure out what notes he was playing. And that's how I taught myself. George Wright was the prolific theater organist of that era. He had a lot to do with bringing hi-fi in it. And also, one of his recordings of Quiet Village was played through many Klipsch horns because it had this incredible low 16-cycle pedal note. And birds flying and all that kind of stuff. It was really cool. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I got into playing the organ, and at an early age, at 14, I got a job in a restaurant playing a Hammond organ. The very next year, I became the substitute organist at the Fox Theater in St. Louis for Manuel Wurlitzer that came up out of the pit, and we'd play four times a day in between the movies in St. Louis. Well, that just went crazy from there. I learned a lot about listening, because we had to tune and voice that Wurlitzer. Now, that was very important to my life. You don't think about things when you do them, and you find out later on, ooh, that was really something. Well, the situation was that in voicing and tuning, you have to learn to listen, all the harmonics. As I teach a lot of courses today, hearing is a physical process. We just hear things, do this, do that. But listening is a mental process. You have to dissect what you're hearing. And that's what I learned as a 15-year-old kid voicing that big Wurlitzer. There were 6,000 pipes from 1 inch to 32 foot up on the 5th and 6th floors.
That's
of the
incredible.
Fox. Stan Kahn took me under his wing. He was the organist there, and he needed somebody to help him, somebody to hold notes while he'd be up tuning and various things and so on. And then, of course, to do his substitute shows. He couldn't be there all the time. So what an incredible part of my life that was. And I played for about 12 years professionally, and it's all theater organ. And I really got tired of it, playing every night, so on. So I come back to my little home of Marissa, Illinois, 2,000 people down in southwest Illinois in the coal fields. And I started a little music shop. I had no idea what was happening. I was so engrossed in the whole situation of theater organ. I hardly knew who the Beatles were in 1966.
So you were more into the mechanical side
of it. Oh, absolutely. Because all during this period, Colleen, from the age of 15 out, I got into ham radio. Now, we're not talking about there's so many aspects to ham radio. I wasn't so interested in talking as I was building. And I, again, had this incredible thing happen. I met a guy on the air the second week that I had my little transmitter that my parents had bought me at Walter Ashe Radio in St. Louis. I met this guy on the air, and he was building this very special transmitter, and I would be there every night to help him adjust it and so on. Come to find out that was Larry Burrells, who was the chief engineer of CBS Radio in St. Louis. Oh, but when you talk to a speaker through a microphone on ham radio, you don't know who that is. It could be Joe Walsh. Mm-hmm. It could be Ronnie Millsap. It could be King Hussein. Really, yeah. you didn't know. Mm-hmm. Well, he was an incredible help to me, because as we played the Fox, this is how my whole life is, it intermingles so much. As we would play the Fox, we'd have 2 or 3 hours in between the 8 minutes we played. I would go down to KMOX, and he taught me the color code, taught me how of the resistors. He taught me how to solder, how to use a Greenlee punch, and all this kind of stuff to make things. I was a ham radio operator that was a builder. Yes, I talked on it, but didn't talk as much as I built. I loved it, and I learned all these things. Well, after I figured I was going to come back and not play every night and all that, I opened this little music shop, and I got a Hammond organ franchise. That was amazing, but I did. And I started selling Hammond organs to homes in this mid-60s. It was a big deal. A Hammond organ was almost like a vase to a lot of people.
We had one. I learned on a Hammond organ as well.
Everybody had one.
Everyone had one.
And so I started selling, and all of a sudden, here comes kids with their things, and they'd say, "Hey, can you fix this? It's a music shop." And I'm going, "What is that?" Well, this thing was a guitar amp, and I had never seen one. How naive I was. No, how possessed I was about ham radio and about the theater organ. And I said, "Well, yeah." I turned it upside down, and it had a pair of 6L6s and a 5U4. That was what was in the modulator of my Harvey Wells transmitter. I knew that circuit well. So I fixed it, and I knew what was wrong with it. He tried to make it go to 12, and it only went to 10.
Didn't go to 11.
Pop, boom. And so I had all the parts. Ham radio operators, we don't throw anything away. And so I
bet your wife likes that.
Oh, yes. And she loves it. And the thing is that they started passing the word. And these kids would come down out of St. Louis and Champaign, Illinois, and Springfield, REO Speedwagon. They weren't known by that yet, but they were still in high school. Michael McDonald, Danny Fogelberg, all kinds of groups in the St. Louis area, Bob Cuban, Faustus, and so on. But I would fix their stuff. At the same time, the promoters in St. Louis, they found out about me that I would rent them a Hammond organ. And so the groups could come to St. Louis, and the promoter would furnish the Hammond organ. And I'd go to these concerts, and it was an incredibly strange world for this straight kid. I'm going, wait a minute. The PAs were awful. They were little bitty stupid columns of 4 or 5 inch speakers, you know, 6 or 8 up to fill 20,000 seats. Are you kidding me?
Exactly. You could see that with the Beatles playing at Shea Stadium.
Yes.
In the 60s. It was just crazy.
It was. Same era, okay? But here was this ham radio operator that could listen. And yes, I didn't play guitar, but I knew that feeling because of all the concerts that I had done on the theater organ. You get this feeling in your stomach, just a little bit above your belly button, when you're out in front of a whole bunch of people and something's not working.
But you had a very fortuitous event when the Fox Theater were getting rid of their loudspeakers.
Well, one day I'm riding down the byway there on Grand Avenue. I'd stop in. I see the old Fox boys, and I hadn't been there for quite a few years. And I pulled in there, and there's George. He was the stagehand. And there's all these big boxes sitting out the back by the trash bins. I'm going, "What are you doing, George?" And he said, we're putting in a new sound system. And I said, "What's all that out there?" "Well, those are our old speakers. We're throwing them away." I said, "Can I have them?" He said, "Well, sure." So I went and got a truck. Mm-hmm. Now, these were A4 Altex. These were big dog, 16-foot front-loaded. They were super. Mm-hmm. And much better than I'd ever seen. I'd seen them, but not own. Mm-hmm. So I took them to Marissa. I knew Macintosh was a good amplifier, so I called Gordon Gow, and I bought a whole bunch of Macintoshes, and I put it together as a sound system, and it was good. I had to build this mixer, because the mixers we had were little Altex that had six knobs on them, no EQ, no nothing, just a level, big knob, you know. Okay, well, we started doing shows. Now, we're talking about shows. They would bring in Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and Ted Nugent, all these kind of people. Well, I understood that the big need was not their Hammond organs. The big need was, we need a better PA. And so here I am with all of this stuff from the Fox. One day, I get this call from George Bales. Hey, Heil, you got that big PA thing working? You got those speakers from me? Did they get them to working? I said, yes. Talk to this guy. He said, this band came in here at 4 o'clock today to set up, and their PA isn't here. Their equipment didn't show up. Seems as if the little story goes that their sound man and the equipment was confiscated the night before in New Orleans by the drug agents, and so they took him back to California with the truck and the gear. He was on probation.
Who could Owsley, this band be?
Yes. And he hands the phone to Jerry Garcia. And I told Jerry what I had. I had four Altec A4s, and I had radio horns, and we had tweeters and Macintosh amps. You got Macintosh amps in it? Hey, get it up here.
Because that's what they were using when Owsley was doing their sound.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that whole combination that he heard of Altec, JBL, and Macintosh was the door opener. And then he heard that we had this Langevin console, and that was it. So we got up there about 8 or 9 o'clock. We finally got going. And there's an article written in a magazine. You can follow it by going to Google, putting "The Night Rock and Roll Sound Was Born." This guy, whoever he was there. He had to be. Every word is true. There's a lot of things written today that's not quite there. This was absolutely 100%, and it was the night rock and roll sound was born.
WPWK, brought to you by Klipsch Audio.
This is Colleen, and with me in the studio is Bob Heil of Heil Sound, and he was the guy responsible for the modern PA for rock concerts. And we just heard how that story happened with the Grateful Dead, but there were a lot of other bands that were kind of swinging through town that you got to join up with that really kind of furthered your career.
There were many, and they all would come to Kiel Auditorium or the arena, and we did a lot of outdoor things also, because the system was huge for those days, even for these days. And I was able to really meet so many of these people, and I didn't meet them as a fan. I met them as a sound engineer. Here was this dude that had a truck full of gear, and it was big stuff that they had never played before.
But were you a fan of rock music at the time?
No. That was the thing. I was such a geek with the theater organ stuff. But I quickly learned what was going on. Because, you know, rock music got a bad deal because of the parents, you know, and Elvis Presley and all this bad stuff. But when you got into it, there was an incredible amount of technology and an unbelievable amount of talent. And what happened with a lot of these groups, they'd have some sound guy that was a sound man for a bingo parlor, and oh yeah, this is your sound man. And he would not respect that. There's a great story about that, where the St. Louis Symphony had a summer home in St. Louis, just a time that the dead came through. They had a summer home. They set up this incredible tent. They had an outdoor facility for the symphony. And it was an air-conditioned thing. It was really great in a natural amphitheater of Southern Illinois University. And the first season was just terrific. Of course, all people would come out in all their nice clothes and sit in the air-conditioned tent and listen to the symphony. Okay. And the last day of the last season, they thought, and these are their words, we thought we would bring somebody in for the kiddies. And they brought Iron Butterfly in.
And for the kiddies.
For the kiddies.
In Agata DeVita.
Yes. And they came on stage and blew up their sound system. I mean, literally blew the speakers out of the little column speakers that they had. Bozak stuff. It was really good for the symphony, okay? And the sound man was a ham radio buddy of mine, called me right after that, and he said, hey, aren't you doing all of those rock guys? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, I'm going to give you this contract. I don't ever want to see them again because I think I'll slash their throats. They blew up my sound system. And we became the house sound for the Mississippi River Festival each summer for 7 years, six nights a week. It was incredible. And the first thing I did was made a trip to Hope, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And we'll come back around to that. Mm-hmm. And we built this outdoor PA using what else? Clip speakers that Paul helped us build. But anyway, there you are with all these sound people not respecting. You know, he said the bass player, he doesn't want any treble and he doesn't want, or he wants treble and he doesn't want a lot of bass. I thought he was a bass player. I said, well, he's got treble lines that he played. No, he's a bass player. You couldn't make them understand. As a theater organist, now you got to understand, a theater organ is a unit orchestra. You are the guy that pushes all the 300 buttons down to make things sound as you want, and you direct all these sounds. And that was part of my life in being able to do that and listen. And when I'm listening to the Grateful Dead, my wife is always kidding me about it. I don't know a lot of the words of these songs. I didn't sing along with them. What am I listening to? Just as you played that last record, I wasn't listening to the words.
I was singing along.
I knew you were. However, I was listening to what the guitar harmonics were and how they were meeting with the bass player, the line the bass player was doing along with the drum. There's all this stuff that's happening. And a lot of people maybe, probably don't listen that intently. That was my job.
Very analytical.
Absolutely. So that every one of these guys, the bass player, the lead guitar, the rhythm, the drummer, all of their pieces had to intermix, but they had to mix acoustically. And up until we came along, they'd just shove a couple of big speakers and a couple of microphones and let it go. No, you have not taken the availability of all of this talent on that stage to mix all these sounds.
Now, there was another very talented band and a very loud band coming from across the pond, and they were touring, and you met up with them?
Well, after the Grateful Dead thing, we went on the rest of that tour, of course, with them. I got very, very close with Jerry Garcia. You see, I'm a guy that even today I have never tasted beer or smoked a cigarette. I was straight man, but I wasn't a Billy Graham preaching to them. Whatever they wanted to do, they did. But I respected their lifestyle, and I respected what they needed. And when they came to me, when Jerry would come to Marissa, Illinois, 50 miles out in the coal fields of Southern Illinois from St. Louis, he wanted something. He wanted to talk technology. Hey, can we do this? Can we do that? And no is not in my vocabulary. Of course we can. And so I was very, very honored and blessed that I respected them and they respected my capabilities of helping them. And it was just wonderful to be able to work with the bands like that.
And I'm sure they felt it was wonderful that they could get the sound that good. Because,
absolutely.
Because we were talking before, live PAs previously had been so poor.
Yeah, in fact, there's another little side note there. Jerry was mentioning steel guitar. He said, boy, I'd sure love to learn to play the steel. Well, the prolific steel guitar teacher was in St. Louis. He taught all the Nashville pickers, Scotty DeWitt. And I said, really? I picked up the phone. I called Scotty. I said, you home? Yep. I said, don't go away. I put Jerry in the car, and we drove up to St. Louis to and it turned out that Scotty taught him how to play steel. The next band, New Riders, okay? You can put that all together. And here I was involved in all of this in the background. I wasn't the guy out with the spotlight. Didn't want to be. I was the guy. Pete Townsend says it a lot. Leave the guy alone. He's got a soldering iron. He makes it sound good. And he can drive the truck.
Because he's straight.
Yeah, well, this whole thing at the Fox hit the front page of Billboard magazine. The night rock and roll sound was born. And I started this one article that we had gotten the Grateful Dead contract to do this. Well, everybody was calling me. And we were out with Chaka Khan at the time because she had a big hit using our talk box, which we'll also talk about in a little bit. And I get this call, and it's Peter Rudge. And he said, hey, you got that big sound system, right? And I said, yeah. He said, you got to be in Boston tomorrow. I said,
with
no.
The sound system?
Yeah. I said, no, we're in Chicago on tour with Chaka Khan. I can't just stop. No, you got to be there. We're in big trouble. I said, well, a couple of things. Who are you and what are you talking about?
There's a little pun there, Bob.
Yeah, right. He said, well, I'm the manager of The Who. Yeah, so? He said, well, we came to America and we got all this new music and we brought our sound system and it's four little columns and we just are getting massacred by the fans and by the media because they can't hear us. Because since we've been here 4 years ago, sound systems have really blown up in their size. Well, I wonder who had something to do with that. So I said, okay, here we go. So I call a company in Chicago that went ahead and covered the Chaka dates. I didn't want to do that. I hated doing that, but what could I do? And I said, well, how am I going to get this from Chicago to Boston? We're in a plane. I said, you don't understand. This is a 40-foot semi full of stuff. Rent a plane. I said, you paying for this, right?
So those were the good old days when rock and roll had some money.
Yeah. And so we rented a Tiger Air freight jet and flew that stuff to Boston. And that was the night that changed The Who. I mean, they were ready to quit. No ifs, ands about it. Roger Daltrey had walked off the stage at soundcheck. He said, that's it. Because it was just awful.
And no band wants to sound terrible.
No. And we changed it. And the comment that Townsend, I didn't know these guys, but got to know them pretty quick. But the comment Pete said, I said, is it okay? And he said, finally, a PA that we can't outplay.
You're listening to WPWK, Keepers of the Sound.
This is Colleen with you on WPWK, Keepers of the Sound. And in the studio with me is a man who has also kept the sound himself. That's Bob Heil of Heil Sound. And you had a great story about The Who's Bob O'Reilly, which we listened to earlier.
Well, when we got with them, I wasn't sure what was going on because they were wild, crazy guys. But when they took that stage, they commanded the auditorium. I hear so often people say, this is the greatest rock and roll band in the world, and they'll name all kinds of bands. I'm sorry. If you were ever at the height of The Who during Bob O'Reilly and all those times, if you ever saw some of their concerts, there was no question they were the best live rock and roll band. I mean, the show was incredible. They didn't have pyro, they didn't have a lot of lights. It was energy, and they had it.
And great musicianship
as
well.
And they came over, and they had these junky little speakers, and we fixed that real quick with all that stuff. But then I'm standing back at the concert. They're mixing on stage, by the way, because their fifth member is Bobby Pridden, who went to grade school with them, and they're a family. And he drove the truck. Well, when the band's playing, and what's Bobby going to do? Well, let's let him run the soundboard. And so he just evolved into that. But he was also running a lot of effects for Pete, so he had to be close to him. So he mixed the PA from the stage.
Wow.
It took
That's
us
incredible.
A whole tour to get them to let us move it out front. And they did. And Bobby stayed on stage and mixed monitors. But Then the great thing happened where I'm going, they had this little Revox tape recorder, little bitty guy. Now, what are you doing? Well, we're playing the backtrack tapes. I said, from what? Well, that's all of Pete's synthesizers and piano and all of that. And I'm going, really? Huh. Well, bottom line is, I flew to Mountain View, California, and I had Scully build us two really nice transport decks. We put them in anvil cases, made them roadworthy, and then we would have a click track, and we would play that so that Keith could stay on track, and then the other track was the synthesizers and all of the things that Pete Townsend had done in his studio. Well, that changed the whole conjecture of how they sounded on stage, because the sound was so much better. And not a lot of people ever ask about, where are those two guys playing? Well, it was from those tapes. And then you'll also see, at first we started playing through a radial horn right behind Keith head so we could get that click track, okay? But the problem is the band was so darn loud he couldn't hear that, so I said, give me your headphones. And so we put his headphones on, but he moved around so much, and there are pictures of this, we would duct tape his headphones to his head. And you know, you look at that, Colleen, maybe only the Who would be the craziest band in the world that let you do that.
Or Keith Moon.
He was just insane. But Keith Moon was the most incredible drummer I've ever stood behind. I stood behind Pete's amps all the time, right at the corner of them, because there was so much going on with Pete. And we had built CellSync into these recorders when Scully built it, so he could adjust the speed of them from his guitar amp stack. And that was another thing that we did, is that he was crashing his amps every night and all that. And so I said, why don't we build a dummy stack and put all your amps over here in a rack? And that's what happened. Bobby Pridden and I put that together where he could knock over the guitar amp speakers while there wasn't anything in them. Mm-hmm. And that worked great. But we worked technically with everybody to try to make a great show, but not to take anything away from their technical part of things. It was amazing. I was also involved in that historic concert that they did four nights at the Cow Palace where Keith Moon passed out. And if you saw the video of that, you'll see the Heil Sound t-shirt where we were around behind him and helped him underneath, and the kid jumped up from the crowd and finished the concert. What an incredible part of history that is, if you don't know about that one. But that was incredible. And
and the Who really kind of puts you on the map as the go-to guy for concert PAs.
Yes. Well, they were the loudest band. Mm-hmm. So what kind of PA did they have? Well, it was ours.
And loud, but clear.
Yeah, but I learned that. From Paul Klipsch. Mm. It's okay to be loud. I mean, there's a whole chapter about Paul that we really want to talk about here in a little bit. Paul taught me not only to be loud, and he didn't like loud. I was the first time his manager at the plant in those days, Bob, told me one time, he took me aside and he said, as Paul was out there running around in the field in front of his office and his lab, he said, this is the first time the old man ever heard rock and roll. Did you know that? And I said, no. He said, yeah, he didn't want it to be, he didn't like all that loud stuff. And yet after he figured out what I was trying to do, he said, just remember, kid, it's okay, I guess, to be loud, but you gotta be good and loud. And that was the very thing that I spent some time with George Wright, my great mentor of the pipe organ, the theater organ. He was the giant of theater organs. I was so fortunate that he came to the restaurant a couple of times, and I got to spend a couple of days with him then, and he mentored me. And that was one of the things he had told me years before. Anybody can play this thing loud. You just push all the buttons down and play loud. I want to teach you how to play it good and loud. And I heard it reverberated again from Paul Klipsch. It's good and loud. And that's what made Heil sound systems better. That is what makes our microphones today better. The articulation is there. You don't have to equalize it. We didn't have EQ in those days of the PA. We had to do it with not with electronics and mixers and all this.
Trying to accentuate different frequencies or take them off.
I learned it from Paul Klipsch. You do it with the speakers. And that's where we were set apart from all the others. There were a lot of other people out there doing loud sound systems, and they got in the scene quickly. But not everybody was good and loud, and I learned that from The Who, and it carried on from there. Every band was after us. As you just played ZZ Top, we did their first tour. I got a call. Hey, he said, this is Bill. I'm the lawyer and the manager. I got this little band down here in Texas, and we think they're pretty good. And he said, you got that big PA I read about. And I said, yes. He said, well, I want you to do my little band from Texas. Now, I had no idea what he's talking about, right? Well, Bill was the manager of ZZ Top, and we did some of their first. I have a wonderful picture of them in a park with our home-built system at the time. It wasn't covered. It was just good old raw plywood, but it sure sounded good. And they didn't have beards.
Not back then.
True story. But gone on, they're using our microphones today, and we have a resurgence of that, of all these bands coming back into our lives. They were like Paul, or like Joe Walsh says, my best friend, Joe Walsh, ham radio buddy, he said, but now you're on the other end of the wire. Yeah, I guess that's true.
Well, there were a lot of other bands as well, such as Humble Pie and BTO. Bachman Turner
Yes.
Overdrive. Do you want to talk about
Well,
them?
Well, Humble Pie, we did this so many years with them. In fact, their road crew, many of them moved to Marissa. Small town, they loved it. Small town America. Mm-hmm. They would say, it's just what we see on the telly when John Wayne walked down the street. And that's what Marissa looked like to them. And they would. My dad had some rental houses, little rental houses, and he'd rent them to the roadies. They lived there for some years. And then I had this gal, Penny, and Penny, she kind of like fell in love with one of them, and she wanted to get married, so she got married in our home.
Oh, wow.
And all the roadies. And we had people from New York and California, and then the limos were coming in. Why, it was crazy, because the only limo you ever saw in Marissa was funerals. No, buddy. These were rock and roll stars would come to the wedding, and we had it in our home. It was really cool. And about 6 months later, she called me one day. She says, hey, I am with Peter Frampton right now, and I need a Christmas present. Can you help me? And I said, yeah. I said, well, I'll send you something. And she gave Peter Frampton his Christmas present of 1974, which was a Heil Sound talk box.
WPWK, brought to you by Klipsch Audio.